The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The nation watched on big screens for hours yesterday as the votes ticked down and legislators gave impassioned speeches. But in the end, it handed Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff an impeachment vote that wasn't even close. The case moves to the Brazilian Senate, where the president may be tried and then removed from office. President Rousseff will be forced to step down while legislators debate the case, which is all about the influence of the Brazilian oil giant Petrobras, influence on politics going back many years. Joining me now from Brasilia is Joseph Leahy, Brazil bureau chief for the Financial Times. Joseph, welcome.
Hello, John.
What does this finally mean for the Rousseff government, and what could it finally mean in terms of airing all of these charges and countercharges that have dominated Brazilian politics for more than a year now?
Well, this means effectively the Rousseff government now hangs on a thread. The next step in the process is that the process will go to the Senate for the beginning of what will probably be the formal trial. The Senate has to accept the petition first, but it's expected to do so. It only needs to do so by a simple majority. And then if it does so, then she'll be suspended and her vice president, Michel Temer, will take over. So effectively, most analysts believe that once she gets suspended, barring surprises, it could be the end of her time in power and the 13 years of her PT government, the Workers' Party government.
And this trial will be an adjudication of what, the entire 13 years or who will be called to the stand?
The grounds for her impeachment are largely technical. She abused the budget, that she fudged the budget spending to try to disguise a budget deficit. But really, this is much more than this. This is a political trial. So she will be the defendant, and she will probably, once the trial comes to the Senate, she'll be accused of, as you mentioned, corruption in Petrobras, of destroying the Brazilian economy, which is in free fall, and of sundry other crimes. The key thing is that the opposition is perhaps using this process to grab onto power.
And this is why she, of course, is describing this entire process as a coup by other means. Does that argument have much sway in the population?
It has sway in the left of the population. So particularly the sort of the hardcore support for the Workers' Party, which some people estimate that the hardcore would be around about 20%. She did win the last election with just over 50% of the vote. So she also has the support of the poor, particularly in the northeast of the country. So it is a divisive debate. The allegations that this is a coup are perhaps a political ploy that she's using on her part. It's not technically a coup. The opposition is following the Constitution, and the process has been repeatedly supported by the Supreme Court. Her argument is that the charges themselves did not constitute a crime of sufficient gravity to impeach a president. And that's an arguable point. But what the opposition will now try to do will be to bring in other arguments, as I mentioned, the Petrobras corruption case and other allegations against her, to try to make this look a little bit more legitimate.
The opposition, what opposition program and moral standing do they have, should they take over? I mean, would they change the course of the Brazilian economy, fundamentally shift things politically in Brazil?
The key phrase here is really, what moral standing do they have? The people who are impeaching, or particularly in the lower house, are all themselves involved in the same scandal, in the Petrobras scandal. Some of them are actually being investigated as we speak, and could even be charged before too long. So this is probably the biggest problem with this process is that those who are judging are also don't have the moral standing or the general support of the population to be able to do this kind of process. Having said that, Michelle Temer is not deeply involved at this stage in the Petrobras scandal. This is the vice president who would take over. And he has proposed an economic program that is seen by economists as a little bit more orthodox, and perhaps if it was able to be implemented, would restabilize Brazil's economy, which is in dire need of some kind of help.
The economy in turmoil, the politics in turmoil. Reporting from Brasilia, Joseph Leahy, Brazil bureau chief for the Financial Times. Thanks so much, Joseph.
Thanks, John.
If Saudi Arabia had some signal that after months of low oil prices, it could compel an agreement on limiting production among major OPEC and non-OPEC producers, it was sadly disappointed by what happened at the meeting in Doha, Qatar, over the weekend. Russia and Saudi Arabia put on a good show of cooperation in advance of the meeting, and oil prices rose all last week. But the Iranian oil minister was absent from this meeting, and an expectation that the Russian minister could convince Iran to go along with a freeze went nowhere, and in the end, there was no deal. Now prices are plummeting. Dan Dicker, oil analyst for The Street and oilprice.com, and author of Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of Saudi America. So, Dan, who wants this current situation anyway?
Who wants it? I guess consumers want it.
Sure.
The more pathetic these meetings turn out to be, the more incompetent the oil producers seem to be when they come together to try and cobble together even the lowest bar of agreements on production and fail. I mean, I guess it's the consumers who win when this happens.
And Saudi Arabia will continue production at this level. This was only going to be a freeze. If it hurt anyone, it would have been the Iranians, who are trying to gear up post-sanctions and wanted no part of anything that was going to force them to keep from coming
online.
Yeah,
the bar was – it's hard to believe how exceedingly low the bar was. The expectations were going in that they couldn't even reach. I mean, the production freeze that they were looking for were January levels, which are 400,000 barrels a day higher than where they're producing now.
Mm.
Now, to imagine the Russians being able to produce more at this point is zero, and the Saudis being able to produce more at this point is close to zero. So the ability for them to apply a freeze and actually stick to it would have been very, very good. But again, it's like, I don't know, it's like a family meeting. Like, everybody sort of has these ideas and arrangements before grandmama dies, and then everybody gets together to try and divvy up what's left, and nobody can agree on anything. Mm. All the memos that went out before the meeting happened seem to go out the window. Nobody seems to understand what the other guy is trying to do. Everybody walks into a meeting room thinking there's going to be something that happens, some agreement, and there is none. And everybody walks out disappointed and confused.
And there's no secrets here. Saudi production cost is something like $3.50 a barrel. The Russian production cost is something like $4 a barrel. They can continue to pump this way, although I read today that the Russians are actually exceeding the production of the Saudis right now.
Yes, the Russians are clearly the number one producer of oil in the world. But they have a problem because their economy is so deeply in the skids that at this point they do not have the money to continue to increase production here. In fact, there's been a big movement inside the Russian government to tax very heavily the three majors, Lukoil and Rosneft and Gazprom, in order to keep their economy afloat, because the only economic winners that the Russian economy has right now are the large oil companies, but they're going to really bite off a leg in order to feed the rest of the body here, because it is the Russians it is the Russian oil companies that support the economy as well. So they're in a very, very tight spot here where they really could use a higher price for oil, despite the fact that their recovery costs are very low. They really need a very large margin of profits in order to keep their economy afloat.
What about U.S. production? It's relatively high and actually has been undergirding this whole inability to reach a settlement on a freeze. I mean, the U.S. production is causing a surplus.
Indeed, but here in the United States, we do not get state support for oil production, and in fact, we are on the downslope of production after gaining 3 million barrels a day in the course of the last 3 years. We are now 700,000 barrels below the peak of production, which was in March of last year. Mm. So there is an effect of low oil prices here in the United States, where production has not only begun to roll over, but begun to accelerate on the downside, where we see more bankruptcies of oil companies, less production, a huge drop in CapEx. In other words, the money that you spend to get oil out of the ground, that has dropped significantly, up 50% in some places, 70% in other places. And this low oil price is doing what we call, I guess, a natural rebalancing of the oil market. So those that don't have the money don't increase production. In fact, it starts to drop. And in fact, the supply has begun already to start dropping everywhere.
In the meantime, the price of oil is a form of stimulus on the global economy. That's what it's working out to be.
Indeed. I think that there is a lot is made of the stimulus of low oil prices on the global economy, and I'm not sure how much it helps or hurts consumers in the end, because the savings from low gas prices, low oil prices, haven't really turned out to be the boon for the consumers that most economists thought it was going to be. On the other side, we do have an economy here in the United States that has lost a couple hundred thousand really good paying jobs in the oil sector. There's a lot of obvious revenue that comes into the U.S. government from a robust oil business here in the United States. I know we don't like to see it, but it's true. And in fact, the United States wouldn't mind, I think at this point, a little bit higher oil price too. Nothing, you know, $120 or $130, but I think the U.S. economy would benefit, in fact, from a $65, $70 oil price at this point.
Dan Dicker, oil analyst for The Street and oilprice.com. Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you, John.
At midnight tonight, the unfortunate annual ritual in civics called tax season ends with the filing of returns. The tax return is a curious document nearly unique to the United States in that it represents a blueprint for all kinds of social incentives, from purchasing solar panels and windmills to holding mortgage interest to contributing to charities, assisting veterans, and deducting all kinds of expenses from your income to lower your tax bill. But Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz says the tax code has failed as an instrument of social policy, and he wants it simplified.
My simple flat tax, I've rolled out in precise detail how it will operate, where every American can fill out our taxes on a postcard. When we get rid of all the corporate welfare, all the subsidies, all the carve-outs in the IRS code, it dramatically simplifies it.
Cruz isn't the first candidate or the only candidate to call for a flat tax, which would mean no more IRS estimated 13 hours of citizens preparing returns and little need for a tax preparer that 90% of U.S. taxpayers reportedly seek for some assistance, paying an average of $200 a year. And it might mean no more H&R Block, the largest national tax preparer, which had revenues of $3 billion in 2014. Ben Castleman is chief economics writer at 538. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks so much for having me.
As an instrument of social policy, is the tax code ideal or a failed sort of creaky machine that doesn't really do what it's supposed to?
Well, I think it's interesting. I think you hear that Ted Cruz quote, and he is sort of blending together two different ideas.
Right.
So one is the complexity of the tax code itself and kind of all of these deductions and embedded incentives that you were just talking about. The other is the sort of complexity of tax day itself, of how difficult it is to file your taxes. And probably most economists would argue we should simplify both of those things. But in a lot of ways, we could probably take care of the latter of tax day right now without actually changing the tax code in any sort of fundamental way.
Because of tech, because of the existence of all kinds of online tools and computer assistants, the tax code, the tax return could be filed with a matter of a couple of keystrokes, assuming you have the data.
Yeah. I mean, if you are one of the 2/3 of Americans who takes the standard deduction, you don't itemize your charitable contributions, your mortgage deduction, your veterans benefits, whatever all of this is, then all of the information that you're submitting to the IRS on tax day is information that is already being submitted by your employer with your W-2 form, by your bank with the interest that they're submitting on a 1099. This is information they already have, and there's really no reason that you couldn't log into the IRS, see the information that they have on you, say, yep, that looks correct, maybe answer a couple of questions and be done with it without this whole process that we go through right now.
And what about the ways in which the federal tax system interacts with state and local tax systems? Sometimes there are federal deductions that are dependent upon state deductions and that sort of thing. Would that have to change to make this simplification happen?
Well, so of course you have a number of states that have no state income tax. And so in those cases, it's relatively simple. Yes, we would have to make sure that state income taxes interacted successfully with federal. But, you know, California has already adopted for several years now a version of this this returnless filing where you can, again, just sort of confirm that everything works and go ahead without needing to file a separate return. There's really no reason those systems can't interact.
But there are people who do need to use these 1099s and have, you know, freelance income or various, you know, categories of income that don't fall into the standard, you know, I work for an employer and they do the withholding. How many people are we talking about there?
Well, so it depends a little bit on how you want to define sort of complex tax returns. So Elizabeth Warren just last week – it's interesting to hear Ted Cruz and Elizabeth Warren potentially agreeing on something
wow.
here, by the way.
Yeah, that is amazing.
But Elizabeth Warren came out last week with a bill to simplify tax filing, to basically allow the IRS to do your taxes for you if you have simple returns. She estimates it could be anywhere from 8 to I think 60 million people or households that would fall under that. That's a pretty wide range, right? So a little bit this depends on, you know, what whether we, for example, the mortgage interest deduction, which is one of the most commonly taken itemized deductions, whether you could account for that through this system. Already, most mortgage banks do submit a so-called 1098 form that includes your mortgage interest. So in that case, there's no reason that you wouldn't be able to have that be part of this sort of pre-filed system.
Because the IRS already has the information.
Again, and this is something that's been looked at now for 30 years. Ronald Reagan proposed something along these lines. At the time, the technology wasn't really there. The IRS couldn't handle all the paperwork in time. But back in the Clinton administration, Congress passed a law signed by President Clinton to require the IRS by 2008 to have a system where people could file without a return for free. And the IRS has basically ignored that. What they've ended up doing instead is working with the tax prep groups to offer free filing for lower income people, people up to an adjusted income of about $62,000. But only about 3% of people who are eligible for that actually take that free filing. Instead, you end up getting added on. You say, "Oh, well, you can file our state returns for $100. Oh, you can, we'll confirm your filings for $100." And all of a sudden, everybody's paying hundreds of dollars for filings that really should be free.
And what accounts for that? Is it lobbyists that get to the IRS and say, "Go slow on this already passed law"?
So if you listen to Elizabeth Warren, then that's absolutely the problem, right? That we have Intuit, which publishes TurboTax
right.
and H&R Block, which have spent billions of dollars lobbying against simplifying tax filing. Grover Norquist and other anti-tax conservatives have argued again against making this simpler, in part because of the pain of filing your taxes every year reminds people of how much they hate filing their taxes. I do think it's a little bit more complicated than that, in that we also have this very complex system that means that if you're one of the third of people who do itemize your deductions, then just sort of moving to this system isn't going to help you. And so that there is a real argument for simplifying our tax code in addition to simplifying our tax filing.
But there is a chunk of revenue that goes to the preparers that is a function of you think they're helping you. It's so complicated that you think they're giving you a deal whether they are or not.
Well, what's that line about get your billion back, America, right, that one of the tax preparation firms uses as an ad line? Yeah, absolutely. You sort of feel like you're getting something back. Of course, what you're getting back is money that you pay – you lent yeah. to the federal government tax-free over the past several months.
Thanks for reminding me of that, Ben. Ben Castleman, chief economics writer at 538. You could read his piece, Ban Tax Day, as we know it, at 538.com. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
How truthful are you when you file your taxes? Mayfield, Kentucky. As a volunteer for VITA, I am 100% truthful. The earned income credit is a huge benefit to families, and I don't want to cause any reason for it to be taken away from our clients. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. And now the political version of an argument that has found its way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
We've never seen a president act so outlandishly in regards to executive orders than President Obama. He's been a failure.
That's former Arizona Governor Jan Brewer, who while in office signed onto a lawsuit accusing the president of overstepping his constitutional authority when he ordered in 2014 that parents of American citizens could apply and get protection from deportation as well as the right to work. The DAPA and DACA programs offer a way to keep families together in cases where children born in the U.S. have citizenship but their parents don't, or if they were brought to the U.S. as children and are facing deportation as adults. Arizona's Jan Brewer and 25 other states say the president is just saying never mind to millions of lawbreakers.
The states are challenging the Obama administration's authority to grant temporary lawful presence for up to roughly 5 million illegal aliens. The bottom line is that it's another case about stopping yet another President Obama's end run around Congress. We know that Congress has established a immigration system governing which aliens may and may not enter the United States and how long they may stay and which aliens must be removed. President Obama and the Democrats, they don't like the Congress immigration scheme, but they lack in the Congress votes to change it. So he just takes executive action, and by executive fiat, his authority, he just enacts his laws.
Governor Brewer's argument will be heard from lawyers representing the plaintiffs in this case, while White House lawyers in the Justice Department will be arguing on behalf of these people.
Mothers, fathers, women, men, workers, people of all nationalities, Latinos, Europeans, Asians, students, just every type of person that you can imagine is affected because immigration is a part of human nature.
Born in Argentina, Thomas Kennedy is now an activist with the Florida Immigrant Coalition fighting for the rights of his mother, Maria Bilbao, who along with her husband brought Thomas to the United States when he was 9. Maria would qualify for protection under DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Lawful Citizens. She is worried about the outcome of the Supreme Court case, though, and the election in November, where she has her hopes pinned on the Democrats winning.
In November, I expect that Democrats win, and I hope they win with both houses because I think it's the only opportunity that we have that immigration reform pass.
Yeah, we expect a landslide loss for Republicans.
What would you tell them about what needs to happen in the next 4 years?
I would tell the Democratic candidates that I hope that they don't play games with our community, that they don't use this as a political football, and that they keep to their word and do exactly what they said they were going to do, because the Latino vote is important. We have delivered the White House to the Democrats for the last two electoral cycles. Our support is not unconditional. The time for immigration reform is now. We can't keep kicking the can down the road. To Donald Trump, I would just tell him that he's a fool. He's a hateful, racist, xenophobic person. He has done a disservice to this country. He has divided this country, and he needs to go away.
Maria, what do you think?
About Donald Trump?
Yeah.
I think that is the monster the Republican Party create. I think that is what the Republican Party deserve, and you know, I'm enjoying seeing how the Republican Party is destroying itself.
One of the poorly understood facts about the immigration crisis in America is that many, if not most, of the millions of people who came to the U.S. illegally were prepared to pay a penalty of some kind once they got established as taxpayers and sort out their status through some means that the U.S. Congress would eventually decide. The last thing most of them expected was that nothing would happen except record deportations, a climate of fear in which an angry decade-long argument over immigrant lawbreakers would develop, until President Obama made an executive order that created the DAPA and DACA programs in 2014. The constitutionality of that order is what's being argued today at the U.S. Supreme Court. Maria Bilbao is a domestic worker in Miami. Her son Thomas, an activist with the Florida Immigrant Coalition, is a legal resident, which makes Maria and her husband eligible for DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans and Lawful Permanent Residents. They never wanted to be in this kind of an argument when they came here from Argentina.
We came here 15 years ago, my son, my husband, and me. It was a big crisis in Argentina. We were in a really bad situation there in a family, and, you know, it was a very bad situation in our country. My husband has here the mother and the sister and the brother. They are citizens. So we came here thinking that, you know, it's going to be easy. But when we came here, it wasn't like that. We went to a lawyer and we tried to apply for something, but the line was 22 years. And the lawyers say you have to go back to Argentina and wait there for 22 years. And, you know, we were in a very bad situation at the time. And we decided to stay.
It's your understanding that if the Supreme Court rules against the Obama administration, you could be deported at any time, right, Maria?
Yes, I know that. I know that. We just want an opportunity. We need a chance to live, work, and stay without fear of deportation. And we know that the law is in our side.
Thomas, how do you see the obstacles to the scenario that seemed pretty reasonable when your mother came here 15 years ago, but it looks impossible today?
Well, growing up, it was really hard. You know, like, we always thought that immigration reform or some type of legal status was around the corner. You know, in 2007, we thought it was around the corner, and that failed. In 2013, we thought it was around the corner, and that failed. Even with DAPA now, we thought that was around the corner, and that got obstructed. It's very difficult living your day-to-day life in fear of deportation, driving around without a license, knowing that any little mistake could just, you know, destroy your whole life, everything that you've constructed. It's just very, very stressful and very, very hard.
How would DAPA help you, Maria?
How it's going to help me? I can drive with a driver license, for example, without the fear of deportation every single day. I can get a working permit. I can go back to my country. I had not been there for 15 years. I don't know. It's going to be completely different. It's going to be completely different. And you know, I feel that we deserve this relief. We are very hardworking people. I'm personally a domestic worker. I have been working for a family for 12 years because people like me, there are millions of Americans that can go out and work every single day because we clean their houses, cook their food, they take care and love their kids. I don't know, I really feel like we deserve respect and dignity.
And do you feel that respect and dignity, Thomas, is withheld by the U.S. government's behavior? Or is the administration saying, it's okay, as long as you don't commit any crimes, we're not going to bother you? Is that enough?
It's definitely not enough. It's what we've achieved for now. And it's really sad that even that small measure of relief for people that work so hard, and it's such an integral part of the labor force in this country, that is all we can get. It's actually very disrespectful. It's definitely not enough. Like I said, we fight for immigration reform with a pathway to citizenship. For everybody that wants to come to this country, work really hard and contribute.
What is the status of your father, Thomas?
He's undocumented. He works in construction. He has his own company. He's a job creator. He's doing well. But at the same time, his status prevents him from growing. He has really hard time getting permits. He has a really hard time driving around. Everything is very, very difficult for him. And a company that is doing pretty well could do a lot better, could pay more taxes because he's a taxpayer. He could be creating more jobs. And it's just an example of how these destructive policies keep the economy down.
Maria and Thomas, do you have health care coverage right now?
No. And that was a big issue last year. I want that Thomas talk about that.
My dad developed degenerative arthritis in both of his hip joints from doing, you know, hard construction labor. He had chronic pain for about 2.5 years. We went to a doctor without insurance or anything, which is very expensive. And they told him that if he didn't have a corrective surgery, he was going to lose his ability to walk. And we were desperately trying to find someone to assist him to finance his operation, to even perform the operation. And we could not. And my dad lived like that, and I may add, working every single day for 2.5 years. Through just sheer luck, my dad ended up remodeling the apartment of an orthopedic surgeon who offered to finance the operation and do it just out of his own goodwill. And through fundraising through our community, we managed to fundraise $15,000, and he managed to get the surgery that he needed. But it's just an example of how politicians have left our community behind, how, you know, the solutions that we need to our problems always come from our community, from the bottom up and not from the top to bottom. Other people don't have the resources or the networks that we have, and the lack of health insurance really could really, really destroy families and really, really destroy lives. We've seen people that have had cancer and that have not been able to get the healthcare they needed, and they've died. People die because of this.
What will you be looking forward to in the oral arguments? Anything particular you want to hear?
I'm going to be there. I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. And I don't know. I think the law is in our side, and I think we're going to win. We were fighting for a long time for DAPA. It was our victory, and we are not going to have them to take it away.
And we hope that we're treated with respect. We hope that they give us the dignity we deserve. We believe that we are going to win, and let's hope that the Supreme Court is on the right side of history on this.
Thomas and Maria, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Maria Bilbao is an Argentinian who's lived in Florida for the last 15 years with her son, Thomas Kennedy, an activist with the Florida Immigrant Coalition. They joined us from WLRN in Miami.
The ladies are away, the boys will play.
Anything can happen. It's going to get crazy.
Dungeons & Dragons!
In the hit sitcom The Big Bang Theory, the ideal night out with the guys is a D&D party of adventurers guided by their DM or Dungeon Master. The fantasy war simulation with elves, bards, beguilers, necromancers, druids, and warlocks fighting or wizarding their way through an endless epic story was born in 1974, and less than 10 years later had more than 3 million players around the world. That number has more than doubled since. This week, the team at Retro Report looks back at the start of D&D and how it got the reputation as an anti-Christian cult. Bonnie Bertram, Retro Report producer, is on the D&D beat. You're a wizard or an elf or
a mancer? I'm not, but I certainly studied and respect them.
Of course you do. Let's listen to the news reports from the time describing, you know, what was seeming to be something really sinister.
This is a quest in a fantasy world of castles and dungeons, monsters and dragons. This world has become real to these people. It's all part of a game called Dungeons and Dragons.
Who was worried about Dungeons and Dragons?
Well, primarily a lot of Christian organizations were. We forget, but the TV and broadcasting landscape in the late 80s and early 90s was really dominated by people who were taking on a crusade, and Dungeons and Dragons fell right in line with the sort of values and worries that they had.
And let's give you a sense of who was actually going after Dungeons & Dragons.
The idea that there were people who were fundamentalist Christians for whom Dungeons & Dragons represented some kind of existential threat to my soul was silly. You could go around and have really satisfying arguments with like profoundly ignorant grown-ups.
Now that sci-fi writer and blogger Cory Doctorow, how deep into this is he?
Well, I think as a kid, he was one of millions of kids who was super into it, and it was sort of a great pastime for them. And in fact, lots of after-school clubs today have Dungeons & Dragons programs for kids. But at the time, there really was this concern that kids were being drawn into this fantasy world, and they were confusing their imagination with reality.
And confusing imagination with reality is what sort of growing up and being a teenager is all about.
Absolutely. And what better place to test it than the realm of imagination with some sort of parameters around a game, right? I mean, now you have kids, right? Like, you'd be thrilled to see come home and see your kids sitting around a table and rolling dice and playing games as opposed to each one of them, you know, calluses on their thumbs playing their little video games.
No, it's true. My son is very into D&D, and you actually bring up a point that it hadn't really occurred to me. Author Junot Diaz talks about another revolution of being in this epic sort of simulation that allowed things that couldn't happen otherwise.
This was a revolution. Being a bunch of kids of color in a society that tells us that we are nothing, being permitted in under our own power to be heroic, to have agency, to do the hero stuff, to take and be on adventures. There was nothing like it for us. It was very, 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 very impactful.
So it really drew people of all
colors and all
Yeah,
races.
I mean, I think a lot of the common denominator was these were kids who were bright and they wanted to do something interesting, you know, when they had time together with you know, their friends, with your young friends. And I don't want to diminish the scare aspect because there was a string of murder-suicides that did have this one thing in common. But it's a classic example of, you know, correlation does not imply causation. And for a lot of these kids like Juno Diaz and other people too, Stephen Colbert was a young player.
Right, sure.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, too, it really empowered them and sort of unleashed their imagination in ways that other activities just didn't do.
And it's alive and well today.
It is. It is. I mean, some people play online, but really it's mostly played with kids sitting around a table talking through the various aspects of what the dungeon master is going to take them on, what adventures they're going to experience together. And it's really sort of a wonderful thing, live-action role-playing. It's great for kids.
And tech and 3D graphics doesn't put a dent in that.
No, there's this great one of the co-founders of Dungeons & Dragons, Gary Gygax, was talking to some kid once, and the kid said to him, I like radio because the pictures are better. And I think for a lot of these kids, too, the sort of very basic aspects of using words to draw out your imagination is such a contrast to what they experience in the digital world that they kind of dig it.
Bonnie Bertram, producer at Retro Report, taking a look at Dungeons & Dragons. The epic adventure continues. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Here's something for you to start an argument with today. Social scientists who can look at the world without the obstructions of national borders and politically popular walls note that just like markets have self-balancing mechanisms, so does the movement of workers. In developed countries, demand for labor can increase growth, and the outflow of a surplus of workers in developing countries can also promote growth by balancing available jobs. So according to the World Bank, if all the developed countries let in just 3% more immigrants, the world's poor would have $305 billion more to spend. The estimated growth in gross worldwide product would be in the range of 67 to 147%. Effectively, open borders would make the whole world twice as rich. Get started on that one. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.